Good morning. I am Nina Rifkin, representing appellant Ronald Sanders. Judge Kleinfeld's comments at the beginning of the session made me realize that perhaps I had overlooked a rule granting me the possibility of requesting more time. I wonder if the court would consider a request at this
point. Our preside is ordinary for death.
Thank you.
Cases.
I would like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal. Pending before the court are Sanders' appeal from the denial of his habeas petition, his related motion for judicial notice, and his motion to expand the certificate of appealability granted by the motions panel. I will address the claims of instructional error, which require reversal, and ineffective assistance of counsel, which require a remand for an evidentiary hearing. And time permitting, I will address the claim that the California death penalty scheme does not adequately narrow the class of death-eligible offenders.
Could you address right off the bat, if you don't mind, on the evidentiary hearing? The evidentiary hearing is focused on the decision of the counsel not to investigate. Is correct?
That's correct. You're talking about the ineffective assistance of counsel claim for acquiescing in Mr. Sanders' request to forego a penalty defense where trial counsel had done virtually.
I know what the facts are. So I spent a lot of time reading the brief, so I just want to set the stage. So let me ask my question so
sure.
You use up your time talking on something that I'm not focused on. You'll get your chance to do that, but I do have a question here because this case poses, at least for me, an interesting intellectual question under Wiggins and Williams rubrics. Here we have what is said to be a defendant who does not want to serve life without parole. To him, death penalty or life without parole are equally unacceptable. Therefore, what is the duty of counsel to investigate under those circumstances? What is it that he is supposed to investigate and present to Sanders, and why, to help pinpoint why I'm asking the question, why wasn't obtaining a psychiatric evaluation of him an adequate investigation, since wouldn't the psychiatric investigation most directly address why he was refusing to consider putting on a mitigation defense?
Well, to answer the last part of your question first, the psychiatric evaluation was done just to see whether Mr. Sanders was rational in terms of making the decision. The psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Kowiak, who evaluated Mr. Sanders, had no background information whatsoever about his life, his background, what potential mitigation could be. Therefore, the purpose of the evaluation was focused only on whether Mr. Sanders was rational and competent, had nothing to do with...
How do we know that? What's in the record to show what the scope of the evaluation was and what its conclusions were?
In the record of the waiver hearing, Mr. Hoover, the trial counsel, says that he believed Mr. Sanders was rational and competent, but he had some question, and he asked that there be a psychiatrist appointed to decide whether Mr. Sanders was rational. Your Honor, I'm sorry I don't have the excerpt of record cite here, but I will try to provide it at rebuttal.
Not much I know, but what else? There's no report that the psychiatrist, there was a switch, wasn't there? There was a Dr. Klein or somebody appointed, but actually...
Dr. Maddie Kowiak did so. If you look at Mr. Hoover's declaration that was submitted by us in support of the petition, he states that he knew nothing about Mr. Sanders' background and he was did not give any information.
Why does that matter? It seems to me the question is, did the lawyer render ineffective assistance by not investigating and putting on a defense at the penalty phase? We already know that the lawyer didn't, and we already know why not, because his client told him not to. So I can't figure out what an evidentiary hearing would be for. I can't figure out why the psychiatrist would need to know all the background stuff. The case where we faulted a lawyer for not telling the doctor some things that the lawyer didn't know was a case where the doctor was trying to create a penalty phase defense. But here, The only purpose of the doctor is to see if the client is capable of making a rational choice to not present such a defense. So I can't see where it's anything but a question of law. Can a lawyer do what his client says when the client is capable of a rational decision on that?
Your Honor, with regard to the deficient performance prong of the Strickland standard, I agree. I don't think you need an evidentiary hearing to conclude that Mr. Hoover rendered ineffective assistance of counsel by not investigating mitigation, and particularly against his own professional judgment that a vigorous defense should be presented.
You're saying that your duty as a lawyer is to violate your client's directives on that?
No. Yes. Your duty as a lawyer is to conduct a reasonable investigation or make a reasonable...
Isn't it your client's choice? I mean, the death penalty, to us lawyers, is a very serious thing. But I can easily imagine a client, well, we've had quite a few actually come through this circuit, where the difference between life without parole and death is not really the big choice for them. The big choice for them is between walking out of the courtroom with an acquittal and getting convicted.
May I suggest something here that I gleaned from your briefs? There's a difference between a duty to investigate and a duty to present the evidence. And as I read your briefs, if the investigation had taken place as you say it should, then since there was some evidence in the record that your client was slightly vulnerable on this question of I don't want anything introduced, had there been a thorough investigation, the client might have changed his mind. However, if there had been an investigation and the client had not changed his mind, then the duty would be to obey the wishes of your client. But as I read your briefs, you were distinguishing the duty to investigate from the duty to present the mitigation.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I would like to respond to both parts of the issue that you've identified. The duty to investigate is virtually absolute, and the ABA standards do say that an attorney has a duty to investigate even over his client's opposition. This Court has...
Those are the standards that the Supreme Court endorsed in Wiggins and Williams.
The Supreme Court in Wiggins endorsed the ABA standards, and the ABA standards that were in effect at the time of this trial in 1980 made that clear. We
have a problem with that. These are ABA standards. They're not the law. They're just what the lawyers on the ABA's committee wish was the way lawyers would behave. And I have a problem with it because as a lawyer defending a criminal case, at the trial stage, I don't know if you do trial defense, but if you do trial defense in a criminal case, time is always the most critical component of your equipment. And every hour that you spend investigating one thing is an hour that you cannot spend working on some other aspect of the case. If the client wants your 100% effort devoted to seeking an acquittal, and orders you not to spend time investigating the penalty phase, I'm a little concerned at your argument that you have to work on the penalty phase anyway.
Your Honor, I disagree. I think Wiggins makes it very clear that an attorney has an obligation to investigate both phases, guilt and penalty. An attorney cannot give any kind of informed advice to his client about his options if he doesn't have the information about what might be the evidentiary possibilities. With regard to the standard of care,
I don't see where it would matter. If the client says, look, I do not want to spend life without parole in prison, and you're showing me that you have an even better chance of beating the death penalty because of my Cherokee forebears or something, that would be worse, not better. I don't care. I don't want to spend life in prison.
The standard of care emerges in this case very specifically from co-defendants counsel Stanley Simran, who tried this case twice with Mr. Hoover, and public defender Susan Sawyer. We have presented evidence about the standard of care in California and in Kern County at the time of this trial, and both of those attorneys explain why it is absolutely critical to investigate mitigation when you have a client who is adamant that he wants, does not want a penalty phase. And as these attorneys in their declarations explain, and particularly Ms. Sawyer in some detail, it's the process of finding out who your client is, of discovering the facts about their life, that gives you the information and the tools and the equipment to be able to figure out really what's going on with your client.
Well, wait, and the point of the investigation is to see what you can put on for defense.
That's right. And in Mr. Hoover's own judgment,
what you're saying is, even though Sanders said he doesn't want a defense, maybe if he knew the defense was going to be a pretty good defense, he would have changed his mind.
He might.
I can't see where you have any evidence in the record, any declaration or anything, that shows that he might have or would have changed his mind if he'd known about if he'd known that his father was cruel to him or about some of the cruelties endured by his ancestors.
Your Honor, let me try to clarify the point. It's not necessary. First, Hoover believed he should put on a penalty defense. The first trial hung on guilt. He did nothing to prepare for a penalty defense. Had he been successful at convincing Mr. Sanders to put on a penalty defense, he would have been completely unprepared. With regard to why the investigation is so important, it's not so much that there's this piece of evidence or that piece of evidence. It's both explaining how that evidence can be used, and also, as Ms. Sawyer explains, that often it's not really that the client does not want any defense at all, but that there is some particular aspect of the penalty process that is the stumbling block. And as a lawyer discovers who his client is.
Any declarations or anything to that effect?
Yes, we have declarations. Susan, we offered in district court.
What to look in the excerpts that shows that an investigation would have affected Sanders' decision?
Well, now we're moving to prejudice. With regard to the standard of care, on an attorney's obligation to investigate mitigation, the declarations of
It goes to standard doing what your client says.
But the declarations go both to deficient performance and to prejudice. And the Sawyer declarations at excerpt of record 631, 633, and the Simran declaration is, I believe, at excerpt of record 629. In my view, the deficient performance prong can be decided as a matter of law. The district court seemed to deny the claim on the grounds that he thought nothing would change Mr. Sanders' mind. To the extent that that determination revolves around a credibility assessment about Mr. Sanders, that cannot be made on the cold record of a declaration. In denying an evidentiary hearing, the district court did not acknowledge at all the expert testimony that we proffered.
I don't understand. Why is that credibility? It's not an issue of whether Sanders is lying. It's an issue of whether Sanders is serious about this decision and capable of making it.
In this case, as was noted, there was ambivalence expressed. The attorney Cook, who was appointed to talk to Mr. Sanders, came back and said he finds some ambivalence about this position. Clearly, Mr. Hoover thought that there was still a chance of changing Mr. Sanders' mind because at the end of the hearing on the waiver, he asked for more time. He said, I think
an investigation might have produced. We don't know what they would have found in the investigation, but certainly without the investigation, isn't it your point that we didn't have enough to know whether or not his mind might have been changed?
Yeah. And the expert declarations of Ms. Sawyer and Mr. Simran confirm that it is possible and it is likely. They report an absolutely remarkable success rate. Ms. Sawyer talks about her job as the penalty phase coordinator in Alameda County, of the vast number of people that come in saying, I want no penalty defense, and how through working through the mitigation and figuring out what it is about the evidence that's troubling the defendant, they've been able to change every single one of those recalcitrant defendants' minds. And
with that in mind and mindful of our time here, can you, assuming we were to agree that this needed an evidentiary hearing, and in what is the focus of the evidentiary hearing, the quality of the mitigating evidence that would have been generated or something else?
No, I think
Judge Kleinfeld said, let's suppose that the evidence that's proffered in your briefs and the record can be established, the abusive childhood, all of the things that you've laid out. And so the record at the evidentiary hearing is established as having Hoover could have, if he'd investigated, come up with a package that was powerful for the jury, which is what Wiggins, in fact, requires, arguably requires him to do. But then what does the evidentiary hearing focus on in terms of what impact that would have had that was relevant to the instructions of Sanders to his attorney? I don't care, the point that we've been discussing here. What is the focus at the evidentiary hearing on that issue?
I think the focus would be what was really underlying the problem here about going forward. And I think that we have a case here where the client insisted he was innocent and where the lawyer, in his declaration, said, I thought we would win an acquittal. My sense, I think what we would prove is that not only was Mr. Hoover totally unprepared for a penalty phase, but Mr. Sanders was too, psychologically and emotionally.
But what is the strength of the mitigating evidence got to do with that?
Well, there is nobody has disputed that there's substantial mitigation, and in this case, a wide variety of things could have been argued. I mean, lingering doubt itself could have carried the day in terms of a life sentence, given the doubt about the prosecution's witnesses identifying Sanders, whether he was – the state has admitted he was not the actual – that they don't know who the actual killer was, whether it was Sanders or Sobreros. There is substantial evidence about his chaotic childhood, about his attempt to serve in Vietnam and being discharged for being underage, about his protectiveness of his siblings, his generosity, his...
I'll understand, but what is it going to? Let's suppose, maybe I'm just not following, but I'm wrestling with this concept here of assuming we're giving it back to the district court. The district court has got to understand what it is he's looking for, and if it's a... where a defendant has essentially interfered with the process of putting on a penalty phase mitigation defense. For example, saying, I don't want you talking to my family and the like. One can see the logic of going out and saying, look, what could the attorney have uncovered if he had ignored that stricture, gone out and conducted a full-blown defense, even put it on through people other than the family, those kinds of cases. But here we have an issue which is an instruction from the defendant that I don't care to get life without parole. So does the district court look at the quality of the mitigation evidence that could have been put on and then try to reconstruct from evidence as to what Sanders would have done had that good case been presented to him?
I think it does. I think what a hearing...
How does that get proved?
How does it get proved? I think it gets proved by the testimony of Mr. Sanders, by the testimony of Mr. Hoover about what exactly was explained and wasn't explained. It gets proved by experts such as Simran and Sawyer showing that the court can believe Mr. Sanders when he says now that had he known of some of this, he would have presented some, because there is evidence that this happens many times and defendants' minds are changed.
What about the psychiatric report that I asked you about at the beginning? Is that relevant?
That only goes to whether he was rational at the time he made this decision.
So he could have been rational but not fully informed?
Exactly. He could be competent to make the decision, but it would not be an informed and knowing waiver if you can waive a penalty defense.
I couldn't find the psychiatrist report in the excerpts. Is it there?
It's not in the excerpts. And it wasn't produced at trial either. It was just given to defense counsel, and then he reported to the trial court that the psychiatrist found that he was rational.
But as I gather, your main point is there really is no need for an evidentiary hearing, because the whole issue is not whether he has to file. I mean, the lawyer has to follow the commands of his client. Yes, he does, but he also has a duty to investigate, and that goes to his ineffectiveness.
Getting back to, does he have the obligation to follow the command of his client, that issue is not presented here, because this Court doesn't need to reach that issue to decide this case, because this case revolves around whether counsel was deficient in not doing the investigation. Had he done the investigation, and had he done everything that Stan Simran and Susan Sawyer say a competent counsel should do, then the Court would be facing a different question.
He was in a position, the lawyer was in a position to put on mitigation at the hearing. He had the whole family.
No, absolutely not. He said.
Put on his mother, put on his father.
He wasn't prepared. He admits that
he never. Prepared 10 minutes in the hall.
That would be an incompetent penalty defense, and you'd be facing a different issue, that he did it, and he did it poorly. He, in his declaration, Mr. Hoover states that he brought the parents to court to talk to Mr. Sanders about the waiver. Had he investigated Sanders' background and known anything, he would have known that was completely counterproductive, because Sanders didn't want his parents there, and Sanders hadn't seen his parents together since he was a young child. It suggests that really what was holding Mr. Sanders up was his family and his parents, which is common. But Mr. Hoover's very clear that while the parents were in the courtroom, he was not prepared. He never interviewed any family members. And his declaration, which is in the record, is very explicit about what he did do and what he did not do. Going back to whether if this case presented the issue it does not present, what does a lawyer do after he's done everything and the client says no? I think that this Court in Landrigan gave the answer, which says it all depends. In Landrigan,
is Sanders in control of his appeal now? I mean, what he's looking at here, if he prevails on this point, is he keeps the conviction. And maybe he gets a writ granted on the penalty phase and winds up with life without parole. Is he in control of that now?
Oh, I don't understand the question about being in control.
He states in his declaration that he would have.
That he would.
That declaration from him, I assume.
Right, that he would have. No, you know, if had he known everything that we discovered and how mitigation can be done and what the options were and that you didn't have to present everything and you could present some of it, that he would have presented some mitigation. But to go back to the point of what happens if the lawyer has done everything, Landrigan makes it clear that it depends on the facts. The client doesn't necessarily absolutely control. The Supreme Court said a client only controls five things: whether to plead guilty, whether to have a jury, whether to be present, whether to testify, and whether to appeal. And that there is a dynamic that goes about penalty defenses that goes on between the client and the lawyer in terms of how much the lawyer has to acquiesce. In this case, Mr. Hoover, unlike Jeffries, unlike a lot of cases, Mr. Hoover specifically said it. He thought a penalty defense should be presented.
Okay, now can I? Well, I just want to. Judge Nelson suggested there was no need for an evidentiary hearing. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I agree with it, but I also recognize that this circuit usually has evidentiary hearings before granting relief for ineffective assistance of counsel.
What should we decide, assuming we decided that there wasn't an evidentiary hearing? What can we decide on this record?
What can you decide? I think you can decide that there was deficient representation.
Because he didn't do any investigation, even if we don't know what. Okay. Could you also address, I know you had some issues you'd want to address, but could you also turn on your claim 45 on the California's weighing of the evidence? Absent the aggravating factors.
Yes, Your Honor.
The California Supreme Court seems to have gone through and concluded, although it didn't use the terms, that the inclusion of the two aggravating factors, which one was ruled unconstitutional and was unconstitutionally taken out because unconstitutionally vague and the other was contrary to state law, they went through and essentially concluded that the error was harmless. So why isn't that adequate under Supreme Court law.
Under Clemens, the Supreme Court has said that when a state Supreme Court invalidates an aggravating circumstance, in California the terminology would be special circumstance, it can only affirm the death sentence if it gives close appellate scrutiny to the effect that the invalid aggravating circumstances had on the verdict. In this case, the California Supreme Court did not even acknowledge that Clemens existed. Clemens was decided 6 months before this direct appeal, and instead of relying on Clemens, the court relied on Zandt versus Stevens, which regards a non-Wayne state where you can automatically affirm a death sentence. In fact, the California Supreme Court did not acknowledge Clemens for 3 years after this direct appeal was decided. The California Supreme Court did not apply the Chapman standard, which is required under Clemens. It said that the two invalidated special circumstances were benign, that there's little chance of prejudice, but nothing in its analysis suggested that it was aware of the heightened Chapman scrutiny that was required. And finally, the substance of its review was not close appellate review. The court never mentioned the penalty evidence. It did not assess the invalid special circumstances in light of that evidence. It didn't assess the weight of the aggravating factors, especially after the...
Just like Morales, a Ninth Circuit case. In Morales, we had something very similar. Some of the aggravating factors were not valid. But what we can, and we, it was also similar in that the state Supreme Court had not done an independent weighing explicitly, although it appeared to have implicitly, just as in this case, without using the words. And what we did is we evaluated those factors and determined that all it would have affected is labeling. The jury would have heard exactly the same evidence. They would have been weighing exactly the same circumstances. The only way in which the labels mattered was whether the person was death penalty eligible, and since there was at least one valid special circumstance, he was. So it was harmless error because it wouldn't have affected at all what the jury had before it. Why isn't this case analogous to Morales in that way?
Well, Your Honor, I'm a little confused about your reference to death eligible, because what we're talking about in Clemens is death eligibility has been decided, and we're talking about, in this case, there was the mandatory weighing instruction, and there was no penalty defense. However, the California Supreme Court, in its own opinion, acknowledged that there was mitigation in the record, excerpt of record 31, that the jury could have found mitigating factors from the evidence presented at guilt. They never considered the combination of no penalty evidence and the mandatory instruction. In light of you take away two aggravating circumstances and you have two circumstances left, no mitigation and a mandatory instruction.
Well, you've got the same facts, whether you call them as special circumstances or not. And the jury had all the facts, and they would have had all the facts.
But I don't think this is a matter of just about labeling. It's about looking.
Why isn't it just about labeling?
Because in this case, the prosecutor focused his argument around the invalid, heinous, atrocious, and cruel circumstance. And if that was taken out of the mix, given the lack of mitigation presented, but the fact that there was mitigation in the record, and the sentencing instruction, I think that the court could have reached a different decision.
Let me ask you a different question. Assuming that we do find that the error is not harmless, what are you proposing that we do? Send it back to the district court? Send it back? Have the district court send it to the Supreme Court?
On Clemens? Under Clemens? This court has said that the Brecht prejudice standard applies, that this court then has to decide whether there's a fair assurance that the two invalidated special circumstances did not have a substantial and injurious effect.
And if we decide that?
Then the death sentence is set aside.
without any sending back to anybody?
According to the law of this circuit.
Under Morales.
Under Morales.
The U.S. Supreme Court, I think, let's see, it sent it back to the state, didn't it?
In Clemens, the U.S. Supreme Court announced its new rule on what's required and sent it back to the state. But there also was a question about whether reweighing was possible in Clemens, which California does not do.
In Morales, we went through the Brecht analysis, and the death penalty stood.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But it could go either way.
Sure. We'll give you a couple of minutes on rebuttal. Figure 5 minutes for rebuttal.
So I can continue? Are you saying I have more time now?
Well, rebuttal comes after the other side argues. Did you want to ask more questions now?
We can give her 5 more minutes now.
Sure, if you like.
If you agree.
Well, I'm fine with that.
Go ahead and take 5 minutes now.
From the court's questions, I assume that you have no questions about the instructional error using the shall-impose death instruction.
I thought that your contentions were disposed of, actually, by controlling Supreme Court and State Supreme Court.
Okay. Then I would like to spend the 5 minutes I have on
I don't know about my colleagues. They may have different views.
Well, I want to answer the question.
It adequately raised in the briefs. Go ahead.
Fine. I can hear you.
That's been adequately covered in the brief.
Then, Your Honor, what I'd like to discuss here for the few minutes I have is the no narrowing claim. The district court denied the evidentiary hearing that we requested on this claim on the grounds that it concluded there was no such thing as quantitative narrowing required under the Eighth Amendment. I think this is an erroneous legal ruling, and I ask for a reversal and a remand for the evidentiary hearing. Furman made it very clear that the five justices joining in the plurality focused on the infrequency of the death penalty, the sense of needing to look at the post-Furman cases established that to minimize the risk of arbitrary and capricious death sentencing, the states must genuinely narrow in numbers the class of people eligible for the death penalty. I think that the court's understanding of this quantitative narrowing is best seen in Penry versus Lanao, where Justice O'Connor, writing for the court, quotes from Justice White's opinion in Gregg. And basically what Justice White does is he sets forth the theory underlying quantitative narrowing. That is, the purpose of narrowing is to make the death-eligible class small enough so that a substantial percentage are, in fact, sentenced to death. And
what about Karras and Mayfield, those two cases? Don't they preclude your argument?
No, I don't think they do. First, I think they were dicta because penalty relief was granted on other grounds. They also addressed a facial challenge. This court did not deal with the empirical showing, the proffer that we have made. In fact, in Karras, the court says nothing about quantitative narrowing at all. I think Mayfield's understanding of narrowing, if I may say so, is inconsistent with Tuilapa. In Mayfield, the court said that at the penalty phase, the class of defendants eligible for death is again narrowed by the application of a series of statutorily enumerated aggravators and mitigators. This just is not correct under California law. It is only the special circumstances that determine death eligibility, so that the sentencing factors and the introduction of mitigation have nothing to do with whether California's death penalty meets the narrowing requirement. So my answer is no. I do not see Karras and Mayfield, which were very Karras it was a footnote at the end of the opinion. In Mayfield it was a very short rejection of the claim. And since these courts granted penalty relief on other grounds, I think this was dicta and does not preclude this court.
What do you mean that this is as applied a challenge? I mean, what specifically? You said they, Karras and Mayfield involved facial challenges. This is as applied.
Well, I think what Karrison Mayfield was saying is, look, look at how many special circumstances are. There's 26, there's 32, however you want to count it. That's too many. That Louisiana only had 5 and Montana only has 6 and Reesley. But our understanding of the understanding that comes out of Furman, particularly out of Justice White's opinion, which is endorsed by the whole court over and over again, is that it's a quantitative proposition. The court in Furman understood that 15 to 20% of the people eligible for death were being sentenced to death at that time. And they said that's what's creating the arbitrary and capriciousness. It's being applied to infrequently. We need to narrow the class and then have the penalty applied in a way that it's not going to be like getting struck by lightning to be sentenced to death. So I think that Furman itself sets the whole narrowing principle up as a real factual question. How many people are death eligible among, how many murders are death eligible, and how many of those people are actually sentenced to death?
You're talking about as applied in this state, not as applied to this defendant?
As applied in this state. I mean, Cheely makes it very clear that a defendant has standing to challenge the constitutionality of the death penalty on narrowing grounds, even if, in fact, his case would have fallen within a properly narrowed statute.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Do prepare for rebuttal, even though we've given you extra time already. Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jane Kirkland, Deputy Attorney General, representing the State of California in this proceeding. I would like to begin by reiterating probably something that's pretty obvious, and that is that the only thing that is really at issue in this appeal is the penalty phase of this trial. The only issue that's before this court involving the guilt phase is one that is fully briefed and we submit unmeritorious. Turning to those penalty phase issues, which the court and counsel have seemed to find significant this morning, I'd like to make a couple of points. It appears that in regard to the issue, which is 3 in appellant's brief, and claim 38 from below, that is the ineffectiveness of counsel, it would appear that what counsel is really arguing is that in a death penalty case, what defense trial counsel has an obligation to do is to persuade his client to put on mitigating evidence, no matter what the client thinks.
I think that's pretty clear from the Supreme Court decisions in Wiggins and Williams, is my personal view, that the Supreme Court has made it very clear that counsel has a tremendous obligation at the penalty phase, even in the face of opposition from his client, to conduct an adequate investigation so that the client can make an informed decision about whether or not to pursue mitigation at the penalty phase. So I think that's, I mean, we can all debate about and read the opinions in those two cases. I think what makes this case, for me, interesting is the fact that here, as we were discussing earlier, it's not clear whether the investigation into mitigating circumstances addressed necessarily the basis on which Sanders decided not to seek a penalty phase defense. The argument of counsel, as you've heard, and I'd be happy to have you address it, is that they have proffered evidence that defendants, for lots of reasons, come up with lots of emotional reasons why they may or may not want the penalty defense put on, and that's what the failure was here. Now, there's a certain amount of hindsight of that because Wiggins and Williams were not on the books at the time of all of this, but that's the standard that we apply.
Right. Williams and Wiggins say that counsel has a duty to investigate, to prepare the mitigation, but in this case, it appears to me that what counsel is arguing is that in addition to that duty to investigate, that counsel has a duty to actually persuade the client to present that
right.
mitigation.
I think that's right.
A duty to present the results of the investigation, which might affect the client's decision. That's how I heard opposing counsel. Not the duty to persuade. but the duty to present the results of the investigation, which might take a vulnerable client from saying, I don't want any mitigation, to saying yes.
Correct. But counsel, implied in that argument is that any competent counsel would manage to persuade the client if they had the ammunition. In this case, I think that question comes before the court because the record is quite clear. Mr. Hoover puts on the record, they've discussed it at length. It does not matter what the mitigation evidence is in Mr. Sanders' mind.
But he doesn't know that, what that, the real question for me on this issue, and I'll tell you where I'm sitting, is not whether or not Mr. Hoover had to follow or Mr. Cook Sanders' wishes, but whether under Wiggins there is a duty to investigate. What happens after the investigation is another question, but the real question is whether there is a duty to investigate. And I notice in your brief you distinguish this case from Silva. Well, I know in Silva's opposition wasn't to all penalty phases. He just said, don't call my parents as witnesses. Seems to me it might make Sanders' case even stronger because, unlike Silva, he never forbade his attorney from talking to any potential witnesses. He just said, I don't want to put on a mitigation.
Right. So in Silva, what counsel should have done was talk to the people that Silva didn't mind him talking to and present what mitigation Silva would have allowed him to present, foreclosing only that one category. But in this case, what Sanders said was, no mitigation, none at all.
But he didn't say, don't investigate. He said, I don't want to put on a mitigation defense. And the issue for me is, what is the duty of the lawyer in a case like this? Not whether to put on a mitigation defense. What is the duty to investigate?
It would appear from Taylor and Williams that the lawyer does have a duty to investigate. And that's the first prong of Strickland. That's the first prong of the ineffective assistance of counsel. And if we say that no matter what Sanders told his lawyer, that Hoover nonetheless had a duty to investigate, then Hoover has failed under prong one of that standard. But under prong two, was Sanders prejudiced? The answer is no, because his point of view that he states on the record, that Hoover states on the record, that Sanders told Mr. Cook, that Sanders told the psychiatrist, that Sanders told the court on several occasions, was that he just didn't want the defense to have any responsibility in the selection of penalty. That for him, both penalties were equally as severe and equally as unacceptable. And he didn't want, on his part, for his counsel or himself to have any effect on which of these unacceptable penalties was the one which would be imposed on him.
How do we deal with Cook, the second opinion attorney?
Well,
you might as well let me finish the question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Where he told the court on the record that there may be some ambivalence about Sanders' position and that more time would be beneficial. Doesn't that create a question as to whether or not something could have been done at that point in time by the lawyers, as in fact the two lawyers who we've heard about whose declarations are in, that notwithstanding defendant's statements about not wanting to seek life without parole as the alternative, that when in fact presented with a full-blown look at what they could put on, they've been able to change their mind. So here we have a statement of ambivalence that's contemporaneous on the record, and we have the testimony of the affidavits of these two lawyers. Why shouldn't that be the subject of an evidentiary hearing on prejudice?
Well, two things. One is the statement of ambivalence, and this is the only, I mean, it's gotten huge in all the representations and investigations of this giant record, but the statement of ambivalence is not Sanders' statement of ambivalence. What Cook said exactly was, he says, this is at excerpts of the record, page 890. He says that he's talked to Mr. Sanders on two occasions over a period of a week for a matter of hours. And after all of this conversation, he says, and it's very equivocal, I thought that during the time of our conversation, of course, I may be mistaken, that there was some ambivalence in Mr. Sandy's feelings about this. So, and what he suggests as a result of that ambivalence is that the matter could be discussed further, not with Mr. Sanders, but with Mr. Sanders's family. And I think that this statement about ambivalence is very speculative. It's not Mr. Sanders. And, in fact, after this statement is on the record from Mr. Cook, the court asks Mr. Sanders again if it's his position that he does not want any penalty defense. And Mr. Sanders says again, yes. And it's he says he doesn't want argument. He doesn't want cross-examination. He will allow objections so that no inappropriate aggravating evidence comes in on the penalty phase, but beyond that, he doesn't want anything. So I think this ambivalent statement is pretty overblown. Additionally, even now, with the benefit of over 20 years of hindsight, the best that counsel can get Mr. Sanders to say in his declaration in 2001, which is that excerpts of the record, page 634, Sanders doesn't say, gosh, I wish we'd put on a mitigation we put on mitigation evidence. I wish we'd put on a penalty phase. No longer do I have this question or reservation about not participating in my penalty at all. He doesn't repudiate any of the stuff that he says on the record. All that he says, all that they can do in over 20 years is convince him to say, well, I would have allowed them to put on a penalty, including at least some mitigation. So even now, he's equivocal about it.
Counsel, does it really matter? Isn't the real question whether his lawyer had a duty to investigate? Whether or not he changed his mind or didn't change his mind, it seems to me, is irrelevant to the question as to whether or not it was a duty to investigate.
But assuming there was a duty to have investigated to the extent that it has been investigated now, there it does matter, because if the investigation or the mitigation wouldn't have changed Mr. Sanders's mind, because it's clear what his mind, his opinion was based on, was not on available mitigation evidence, it wouldn't have mattered.
How do we know what the investigation would have revealed?
Well, it doesn't matter what the mitigation, what the investigation would have revealed, because Sanders's decision was not based on the quality or quantity or source.
At that time, because no investigation had taken place. And the real question was, or to me is, and maybe you can steer me right, is we don't know what the investigation would have shown. Therefore, we cannot say that Mr. Sanders would have maintained his position. We can only speculate. And you say, you know, what he says now to me, I pay no attention to. My real question is whether there is this duty to investigate, regardless of what your client says. Then, having investigated, having presented it, if he says, don't put it on, that's a different question.
But the quantity, as a couple of this panel has pointed out, the quantity and quality of the mitigation evidence doesn't affect that decision in this case. That if we go back and say there's all this wonderful mitigating evidence, then we're also speculating whether that evidence would have changed Mr. Sanders's mind.
We just don't know, do we?
We don't. But everything that's on the record militates against that, because there's nothing in this record. And from those transcripts, from those discussions, from Mr. Hoover's statements about his conversations with Mr. Sanders and with other lawyers, there's nothing in there that gives even a hint that it has anything, that the decision has anything whatsoever to do with anything other than Mr. Sanders' view of the case or view of his desire to not participate in the selection of one penalty over the other, a view that wasn't in one day or one week or one month even. It was a view that Mr. Sanders had expressed to Mr. Hoover at the outset of the case. And then after the conviction, reiterated it. And then Mr. Hoover brings it to the attention of the court, and the court gives him about 10 days which to try to dissuade Mr. Sanders from that point of view, if it can be done, or to at least explore how firmly that view is entrenched. And he pulls in the other lawyer, he pulls in the psychiatrist, and all of that's unavailing because...
I don't want to use up all your time, but isn't that why we give Mr. Sanders a lawyer? That the lawyer should investigate thoroughly to make sure that, you know, Mr. Sanders can come in from day one and say, I want nothing. I'm innocent. I want nothing on the record. Isn't that why he has a lawyer to go out and investigate and come back and say, Mr. Sanders, this is what I found. Now, make an informed decision.
But if what Sanders says at the outset is, if I'm convicted, I don't care whether I get life without or death. And so Mr. Hoover says, but I've done this great investigation. I can guarantee you, you will get life without parole if we put on this. I know, but if he could, Sanders says, no. My point of view is I don't care if it's life without or death.
Then he would have performed his duty as a lawyer. He would have presented everything to his client. His client would have said...
But where's the harm? If Sanders' view is it doesn't matter what evidence you can get, I don't want LWAP and I don't want death and I don't want our...
The thrust, however, of the Supreme Court decisions is that counsel has an obligation to provide the defendant with the best information so that the... And that discharges counsel's obligation as an attorney. Then, with the full deck laid out in front of him, he persists in his adamancy. Then we'd be in a position to say it didn't make a difference and it would have maybe been obvious in hindsight that we didn't need to go through all of this investigation, but that's not what the Supreme Court seems to be saying. It seems to be saying counsel's obligation is to develop the record and put it before the defendant and let the defendant then make an informed decision. And the Supreme Court has emphasized that this duty is particularly intense at the penalty phase. So
but if
that's
that,
the law that we're grappling with.
If that duty means is so absolute that failing that duty, the penalty is invalid, then we've ignored the second prong of Strickland. We haven't looked at it.
Then the question is, well, I don't, that's an interesting issue that's being mooted about here, and I have to think about that. There's a suggestion on the one hand that we just decide there's automatic prejudice from it because once, if we were to assume, reach the legal conclusion as a matter of law, or as a matter of fact, because he didn't do any investigation. But then the question is, as you say, prejudice. And is that something we decide just looking at the record and assume we can't have any hearing or any further evidence on it because it would be all speculative? Or is there some check in the system to say whether or not it would have likely changed his mind? And that's something I haven't made my mind up on yet.
Well,
and I'm still open to consider the first prong, but Wiggins is a very powerful statement from the court about the duty of counsel at the penalty phase, and I think whatever we decide, we have to very much take that into account. And
well,
I certainly understand the logic of your argument about, well, gee, isn't it irrelevant? But I'm not sure. Could you? I don't want to interfere with. Other of my colleagues' questions, but I, at some point, would like you to address Claim 45 and the adequacy of the Supreme Court's carrying out the mandate of the U.S. Supreme Court and how that compares with Morales.
Could we stick with the previous question for just a moment? I'm wondering about the Ninth Circuit case in Silva versus Woodford. Since it is a failure to investigate case. The way the court in Silva states the test is, furthermore, a lawyer who abandons investigation into mitigating evidence in a capital case at the direction of his client must at least have adequately informed his client of the potential consequences of that decision and must be assured that his client has made informed and knowing judgment. Could you tell me, just articulate, how to apply that test to this case?
Assuming the cases were factually similar, and there's...
I know they're distinguishable.
Yeah, there's...
There's actually a factual dispute, and also the client didn't tell the lawyer, don't investigate anything. He just said, don't talk to my family and
right.
friends.
Right, and that's the distinction in Hayes and
I
others.
I didn't tell the lawyer that in the unequivocal way the lawyer claims. So Silva's a much weaker case for the government than the case at Barr.
Right. The statement that you've quoted from Silva in this case would indicate that if Hoover said to Sanders, the consequence of my failing to investigate or the consequence of my failing to present mitigation at this penalty phase is going to be you'll get death, Silva would seem to imply that counsel had discharged his duty in that regard. And the reporter's transcripts of Hoover's statements on the record about his self-evaluation and self-exploration of what exactly he should do with this client who's firmly telling him not to do anything indicate, while he doesn't say it in so many words, I told him he'd get death, there's two or three places where it's clear that he's said to Sanders, we don't have any hope of LWOP unless we put on some mitigation. We need to put on some mitigation if you want LWOP. And,
same thing.
Yeah, and Sanders says, no, I don't want LWOP, I don't want death, and so I leave it up to the state.
You take the Ninth Circuit interpretation of the Supreme Court law on investigation, and it's satisfied because Silva says it's okay not to investigate, to abandon investigation at the direction of the client, so long as the lawyer does two things, adequately informs the client of the potential consequences, and that was obviously done because it's done right there in open court. And second, assure that his client has made an informed and knowing judgment. And that was done by requiring that a second independent lawyer be retained and the psychiatrist to make sure that the client was making a knowing and informed judgment.
Mm-hmm. And interesting in the court.
May I just say, Judge Kleinfeld suggested that this is a weaker case than Silver. Let me suggest that perhaps this is a stronger case than Silver because Mr. Saunders did not tell his lawyer not to investigate. He did not tell him not to interview his parents or anyone. He simply said, I don't want to put on a mitigation defense. Does that make this a stronger case than Silver in terms of the need for investigation?
No, I mean, that what Sanders said to him is, I mean, what's the point of investigating if we're not going to put anything on? So if Sanders says, don't put anything on, that's the same thing as saying, don't investigate anything.
Is that what he's saying? Saying, I don't want any mitigation means I don't want you to do any investigation? I didn't read that in the case at all.
Well, what would be the point? He would be saying, well, I don't want you to put anything on, but I think you should investigate in case you can find something that will persuade me to allow.
The lawyer is to represent him. If he's to represent him well, he needs to do a thorough investigation so that his client has a chance to change his mind and make an informed decision. I agree with you at that point. He seemed adamant. But he didn't say don't investigate, as it was the case in Silva. At least don't talk to my parents. And Wiggins seems to say that no matter what that client says, the duty to investigate is that of the attorney. Well, anyway, I just wanted to assess another approach here.
To be continued.
Let's see. There was... Oh.
Yes, the lawyer did do something, didn't he?
Yes,
he called
I was,
up the parents and got them all to fly out there.
Yes, and he had talked to them to some extent. It's, I think, well, not a turning point of the case. The investigations that are done now in
death penalty. Since I conducted only a general investigation of his background and potentially mitigating circumstances, Then he describes the investigation he did. He doesn't say that he didn't do anything.
Correct.
At page 288.
He started to look at it and then deceased at Sanders' direction. So death penalty mitigation has become an art form, and it didn't, it wasn't like that 22 years ago in 1982. The cases that come out of that era, principally the mitigation consists of family members talking about the potential about the defendant and his life and his upbringing. There weren't these people, psychologists who make a living making social reports and so on. I mean, it was a different.
We have lawyers who make a living shooting the wounded, don't we? They basically testify to ineffective assistance at the penalty phase of the trial 20 years ago.
Yes.
Well, I'm not sure that shooting the wounded may be discharging one's obligation as a counsel.
Probably my phrasing was inapt.
Okay. I think I won't comment on that exchange.
Obviously, we can discuss that among ourselves.
That's a good idea. let's see.
Do you claim 45?
Right.
I would like to understand California's view of whether its Supreme Court discharged its obligation under Clemens.
It's our view, as we stated in our briefs and so on, that the court, although the court did not, the California Supreme Court did not specifically cite Clemens, nor did it specifically cite Chapman, that it engaged in an adequate Clemens and harmless error review. This was also the conclusion of Judge Coyle, the district court judge in this case, that he found that it wasn't critical that the cases be specifically cited as long as the process was engaged in.
Well, how do we I've read the it's a fairly brief discussion, and I certainly accept the notion that they don't necessarily have to cite the precise Supreme Court decision. But there is some terminology in here that doesn't sound like it's applying the Chapman standard, so that's why I'm curious as to how we extract out of this fairly abbreviated discussion. The Supreme Court itself has said if we find it ambiguous, then that's a reason enough to send it back. And it seems rather ambiguous to me. How can you say, for example, it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt when they, for example, say there was, on the burglary, a special circumstance, there's little chance defendant was prejudiced. Is that a beyond a... And
well, they also say it was benign, which
benign.
Certainly...
Yeah.
And one of the things that...
You know, we have to take the... That's why my problem is, I agree, there are the words in there, but we're parsing. Instead of saying this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, they say... we conclude a reasonable juror would not have been swayed by abstract concepts on the heinous instruction. And then they say the burglary murder was similarly benign, which seems to tie those two approaches together, therefore. And then at the end they wind up saying there was little chance. So little chance, is that within harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard?
Well, I would think so. Little chance. I mean, if they had used exactly that same terminology and tossed in a cite for Chapman, we wouldn't be having this discussion. Now, at this stage, our in federal court, the standard, of course, to be applied is the Brecht standard.
That's a less demanding standard. So.
Pardon?
That's a lesser standard.
Yes, and applying that standard to the California's evaluation of it, it would seem that it would meet that standard. It's important. California has emphasized in this case some of the same points that Justice Kleinfeld was making earlier or was pointing out earlier, which was that the special circumstances that were invalidated in this case were not factual special circumstances that took any facts out of the consideration of the jury. They were just categorical categorizations of facts that were already there and well presented, that if you still have exactly the same facts before the jury, whether you call them a special circumstance or not is really not determinative, and that would be certainly a logical conclusion. And also, the prosecutor in his death penalty argument never said you should select death because there's four special circumstances. He argued the underlying facts. He talked about the heinous killing, but he did not overemphasize that any more than any of the other things. He talked about each of the potential aggravating circumstances in turn and spent no more time on the heinous special circumstance than he did on any other special circumstance or any other aggravating circumstance. This isn't a situation, as in some cases, where the prosecutors really honed in on the particular special circumstance that was later deemed invalid. And
he didn't make an argument there, four going this way and only one going that way.
Correct.
Or anything like that, right?
Nope. He didn't do any of that kind of artificial weighing, and he argued the facts of the case more than the special circumstances themselves. And
the Supreme Court addresses it, but here's the prosecutor telling the jury, you have already concluded, and correctly so, that it fell within the special circumstance known as especially heinous, atrocious, and cruel murder, that it exhibited exceptional depravity. So he's essentially saying, okay, you've made that finding. Bingo. To say it's just a label, as the Supreme Court suggests, under a Brecht standard, seems a little awkward.
Well, but if you isolate that statement and apply Brecht only to that one little statement, maybe that's true. But if you look at the prosecutor's argument as a whole, which is what we ought to be doing, looking at it as a whole, it does not have substantial injurious effect. It does not color the entire closing argument or the emphasis to the jury. And
how
the jury
you,
was.
You say we're supposed to look at it as a whole, but so is the California Supreme Court. Where did it do that? It sort of rationalized these statements, but where's the careful analysis under the Clemens standard that is.
Well,
looking at in the entirety of the evidence, you think that's all exhibited? Counsel for Mr. Sanders says no, it's not here.
Well, it could be more complete. It could have had additional citations. It could be more analytical. They obviously, as long as they have come to the right conclusion about it, which we can, by looking at it more completely now, say, yes, they did, because this is the impact of it, then it doesn't really matter whether they wrote down in detail what we might, at this juncture, like them to have done 13 years ago when they wrote this decision.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Set it for five.
Responding first to the Clemens issue, I would like to point out that the same facts argument basically was rejected in Clemens. It was offered, but the court nonetheless found that there had not been adequate appellate review, even though elimination of the special circumstance would not have changed the evidentiary picture before the jury. And I would refer you to our opening brief at footnote 72. I also would, at the risk of pointing out the obvious to the court, that if the court were inclined to grant relief on the instructional sentencing error, it would not have to reach any of the other issues. With regard to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim on deficient representation, I totally disagree with the suggestion by the state's attorney that somehow the standard of care was different 20 years ago. Stanley Simran, who was co-defendant's counsel and tried this case twice with Mr. Hoover, in his declaration makes it very clear that the demanding standard of care with regard to the penalty phase existed. It existed in Kern County at the time of this trial, that counsel was obligated, even over his client's objection, to do a complete investigation of the penalty defense. I also want to correct a misimpression that I think has been made in comments about the record, that Mr. Sanders' parents were brought to Bakersfield only after the conviction in the second trial. In fact, his mother's declaration reveals that she didn't even know he was on trial until the second trial, and that the only reason the parents were brought were to make sure he was being rational about the waiver. Mr. Sanders' parents and his siblings all say in their declarations that nobody from the defense team ever talked to them about the possibility of testifying at the penalty trial. Now, I'd refer the court to excerpt of record 466, 471, 496, and 509 as examples. Mr. Hoover had a whole year, as opposing counsel said, to do something, and yet he waited until the conviction after a second trial to consult with a psychologist to ask the court for help with what he referred to as his dilemma. With regard to prejudice,
I'm not sure I followed that.
Well,
when did it become apparent to him that he would need that kind of expert assistance?
Well, he stated that he had known about Mr. Sanders' position for over a year, and yet his own declaration says, what did I do in terms of investigation? I looked in a suitcase and confirmed that he had been employed at some oil company. He did not do anything in terms of seeking help from another lawyer or, you know, help from the court before the crisis occurred, before it was essentially too late to mount an effective penalty phase if Mr. Sanders had, in fact, changed his mind. With regard to prejudice, I want to point out that this court is not limited to the trial court record in assessing prejudice, and the expert declarations, I think, go a long way to support Mr. Sanders' own declaration that, in fact, he would have changed his mind. Mr. Sanders' declaration is sufficient for an evidentiary hearing. In Hill versus Lockhart, which involved ineffective assistance of counsel with regard to a guilty plea, the Supreme Court held that the petitioner was not entitled to an evidentiary hearing because, as a majority found, he never asserted that had his lawyer explained everything that he said what he was not informed of, he would have changed his mind. So that in terms of an evidentiary hearing, it seems that asserting that you would have changed your position is sufficient. Stanley Simran, who in his declaration at ER 629 says, he knew Sanders well. He knew Hoover well, and he thinks that had Hoover done his penalty phase homework, Sanders, in fact, would have changed his mind and put on a penalty defense. This is not a case like the Hayes versus Woodford case, where at the evidentiary hearing, the petitioner said, nothing would have changed my mind. Well, that ends the consideration of the prejudice question. Finally, with regard to a knowing and informed decision, I would point out to the court the decision in Douglas versus Woodford. Now, that's an interesting case because the lawyer disregarded the client's wish to not have mitigation and went ahead and did it, but did it incompetently. But in Douglas, the circuit says that without discovering the possible options for a penalty phase, neither the lawyer nor the client can make an informed decision not to present mitigation. If the court has no further questions, I'll end it there.
Thank you, counsel.
I would just like to say personally that the arguments both by Ms. Rifkin and Ms. Kirkland were extremely helpful to the court and extremely well made.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I agree with both counsel. Very helpful.
On that, we're unanimous. And maybe on other things.
Sanders versus Woodford is submitted. We adjourn until 9 a.m. tomorrow.